dignity,
security,
freedom,
freedom,
respect,
justice,
justice,
equality,
equality,
remedy,
protection,
fairness,
fair trial,
citizenship,
right,
will,
peace,
movement.
It's my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
expressions.
Expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
leisure,
leisure,
health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on channel SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. I'm Jim Hutchings, and with me is my co-host, Daylene Sliz, and our special guest today, Simon Ganofsky-Larson, who is a professor of international studies at the U of R. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Jim. Welcome, Simon. Today we are pleased to have with us, as you heard, Simon Ganofsky-Larson of the Politics and International Studies Department at the University of Regina. Simon is assistant professor in the department, holds a PhD in political science from York University, an MA in social and political thought, and a BA honors from Dalhousie University in international development and Spanish. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Today, Simon will be discussing the crisis in Honduras and the events that led to the assassination of indigenous leader Berta Cáceres. Did I say that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. After the break, Simon will discuss human rights violations based on his 15 years of research and work in Guatemala. Before we begin, could you briefly talk about what work you are doing and the projects that you are currently working on?
Thank you, Daylene. It's great to be here. I'm relatively new to the University of Regina. I started in the International Studies program this July, and I'm very happy to be here. It's a program with a really strong focus on social justice and human rights in the international setting. I think of myself as an activist academic. I try to focus all of my teaching on questions related to social justice and to try and involve my students in issues related to social justice as well. I worked as a human rights accompanier in Guatemala about 15 years ago, and that was work that led me into research strongly connected to social movements and struggles for human rights in Latin America. I've always tried to take direction in my research from social movements on the ground to try and expand through academic research issues that those same movements are working on. I have a couple of projects on the go right now. One is turning my PhD dissertation into a book. I found a publisher for it, and I'm just editing it to be able to get it out. That was work that looked at the campesino social movement in Guatemala, the social movement of indigenous small farmers, looking at the ways that they were mobilizing in the period since the Civil War ended in Guatemala to access land, and how the relationship between that social movement and the government was changing in a context that is, on the surface, one of post-conflict transition, but one also of the deep re-entrenchment of the same power structures from before the war. So I was looking at how social movements were challenging that. I'm moving into new work with fieldwork coming up soon, looking at how violence is used to support the new economic model in Central America, which is mostly the work of transnational corporations in resource extraction, such as mining, hydroelectric dams, agrofuel plantations. We know that violence is a major factor in making most of those projects function, but we don't have a very clear picture of who's involved, what sorts of organizations, and how they interact with one another. I have quite a bit of close personal experience from my human rights work with different armed groups in Guatemala, and I plan on mapping out the sorts of groups that are involved in the repression against human rights activists, the relationships between them and the relationships that they have with corporations, many of them Canadian as well as governments as well. And that's sort of the what I have on the horizon, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever found yourself in a situation in a violent situation down in Guatemala?
I have, just because of the nature of the research and the work. I haven't ever felt threatened myself because of the work that I do. I think it's actually a privileged role that we as outsiders have, as we're able to investigate and accompany human rights situations without the threat of reprisal in the same way that locals face. But by the very nature of spending time with people who are under threat, yeah, I've been in situations of land conflicts and land evictions and armed confrontations between groups and scenarios that have led to political exile as well, that I've been very closely connected to people who have suffered those sorts of threats and violence.
Mm-hmm. Berta Cáceres was a remarkable woman who fought tirelessly defending the lands and livelihood of the indigenous people of Honduras. She co-founded the Council of Popular and Indigenous Peoples Organization. Can you talk about Berta's life and death and Canada's involvement as a free trade agent and investor in the country?
Yes, Berta Cáceres was a incredible force within the popular movement in Honduras that has grown to a remarkable size and faced an enormous amount of threat and violence since a military coup in 2009 in Honduras. The context of the coup, if I can just go back a little bit and add some historical context here, was a kind of middle-of-the-road reformist president who was feeling pressure from a lot of social movements that were active in the country and decided to support a lot of the demands of social movements. He increased the minimum wage in the country substantially. He extended a moratorium on new licenses for mining companies from outside of the country. And he was engaged in a process to allow for a referendum to rewrite the Honduran constitution, which had been written in 1982 under a previous military dictatorship. So he was not necessarily taking the initiative, but responding to grassroots outcries in the country that this constitution needed to be written. The result was a coup against Zelaya. He was forcibly removed from the country. And there's been a series of first a military transition government and then two supposedly elected governments, but within a very anti-democratic setting. Immediately after the coup, social movements in the country, which had already built to quite a degree of strength, came out in enormous numbers. The largest protests that Honduras had ever seen for months and months following the coup. in that first period of a few months, hundreds of activists were assassinated either during the rallies by military and police or really hunted down in their places of work and home and killed for their role in supporting the social movement that was trying to reverse the coup. Berta Cáceres, as one of the co-founders of COPIN, the Council of Popular Indigenous Peoples Organizations of Honduras, became one of the strongest voices of the leadership of those social movements. As much as each organization had its autonomy, she became one of the best-known faces and strongest voices. The coup itself and the governments that followed have advanced an economic program of supporting large-scale transnational economic development projects such as mines and hydroelectric dams and agri-fuel production in the country. They have reduced the taxes that foreign corporations pay, reduced or eliminated regulations on environmental and labor standards, and otherwise provided incentives for those companies to operate in the country. Canada has been a very strong player in this, both in terms of supporting the post-coup governments, lobbying those governments for the sort of legislative changes that have happened, and also being some of the strongest beneficiaries of those changes as well. Most of the mining companies that are active in Honduras are Canadian. The booming tourism industry in Honduras that has appropriated indigenous Garifuna land on the coast of Honduras is mostly led by Canadian companies. There's Canadian investment in the hydroelectric dams as well. So Canada as a government has been very supportive of the post-coup situation in Honduras, and it's benefited from a context that's been opened up both through legislation and through violence as well. Berta Cáceres and other members of COPIN are no strangers to that violence because they took such a strong role in denouncing the coup, denouncing the changes that have happened afterwards, trying to physically block a lot of the projects like mining and dams. That organization has been subject to a lot of violence, harassment, intimidation, unjust imprisonment, and assassination. Berta Cáceres herself has been under constant threat of assassination for at least since the coup in Honduras. To the extent that the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights issued a warning to the Honduran government that the threats against her life were imminent and issued an order that the government should take measures to protect Berta Cáceres for her work as a human rights defender. The government ignored those orders, and as we know, on March 3rd, Berta Cáceres was murdered in her home while she slept. And the only witness of that murder, who was a Mexican activist from a similar organization who was visiting and who was a close friend of Berta's, and who himself was wounded in the attack, was actually imprisoned and then held against his will for being a witness of the assassination. We've had good news about Gustavo Castro, who is that witness. Mm-hmm. He's actually, just as of yesterday, been allowed to leave Honduras. And as far as we know, will be returning to Mexico. But that's one very small step in the sort of justice and investigation that's really necessary, not just into Berta's murder, but into the surrounding context and general situation that's carrying on even after that murder.
Right. Now, the reason that Berta was receiving the death threats was because the industry was not consulting with the indigenous people. Is that correct?
That's correct. Under the International Labor Organization Convention 169, traditional indigenous territories, indigenous groups in their traditional territories have a duty to be consulted by corporations before large-scale economic activity is carried out within those territories. The Agua Zarca Dam of the Gualcarque River in Honduras falls within the territory of the indigenous Lenca people in Honduras, who actually have agreements with the Honduras government going back to 1911 that establish it formally as the territory of the Lenca people. It's clear under international law, under the International Labor Organization's 169, that the company carrying out this dam had to provide, had to carry out meaningful free prior and informed consultation with the Lenca people and receive their blessing for the project before going ahead with it. No meaningful consultation was carried out. The only semblance of consultation that was done with this project was getting the approval of the mayor from one of the local towns who'd supported the dam, but that doesn't amount to consultation with the indigenous community as a whole, and it didn't translate into their support either. So the work that Copin and the Lenca communities were doing in this area was trying to stop this dam from being built and from the project from going ahead. There are indigenous communities who rely very heavily on the river. It's important for their traditions and spiritual practices. The river plays, for this particular group of people, that river plays a very strong role in their spirituality and in their economic activity as well, fishing for subsistence, for market production as well. So the dam, if it is to be constructed, would violate their traditional practices, their spiritual beliefs. It would flood people out of their traditional land that they use for living and for economic practices as well, which they have legal authority over in Honduras, and it would harm their means of livelihood as mm-hmm. well. So there's very serious grievances, both legal and in terms of the impact on the community, but the project was moving full steam ahead without consultation or listening to those responses. Berta Cáceres wasn't the first person to be killed in relation to the dam. I'm not familiar with the exact number or other cases, but there's definitely been many, many instances of intimidation and a number of murders as well of community leaders who are taking an active role in trying to block that dam project from going ahead.
Mm-hmm. The Netherlands and Finland pulled funding from the Agua Zarca Dam. Do you think the government under Justin Trudeau will take similar steps in support of the people of Honduras?
In a word, no. Although I would really hope that the government does, and that would be a very positive step. Mm-hmm. After Berta Cáceres' murder, she had already been a very well-known figure internationally. Her role as one of the visible faces of the Honduran resistance through such a difficult period and with a lot of international solidarity, as well as her reception of the 2015 Goldman Prize, which is a very highly coveted international prize for environmental activism, made her very well known. And so when she was murdered, it not only touched a lot of people who were connected to Berta, but it sent the message that if she could be killed, anybody could be killed in Honduras because of the degree of connection that she had to international support. If she's murdered, then really nobody's safe in Honduras. And so this sparked off a lot of international response to her murder, more than we've seen with the deaths of dozens and dozens of other human rights defenders across the region recently. There were protests, there were interruptions of meetings of international financial institutions that are involved in the dam's banners dropped, offices blocked. We saw this wave of protest in response to Berta's murder almost immediately. In response to that, and after a second member of Copin was killed just days after Berta Cáceres, these two projects from the Netherlands and Finland decided not to pull, as far as I know, but to suspend their funding in the project, which doesn't necessarily mean it's indefinite, which was a very positive step, sent a strong message, but we have to remember that these were agencies that were in full support of the dam through years of other intimidation, violence, and murder against activists as well. So it's a little bit of a not going far enough, I'd say, or points to the interests involved as well. In the terms, as far as Canada goes, Canada has shown since the 2009 coup and before to be one of Honduras's strongest partners in supporting the economic model that's being implemented in the country, in turning a blind eye to violence that's used in order to push that model through, and one of the strongest recipients, as I was mentioning earlier, beneficiaries mm-hmm. of that model in terms of the activities and growth of activities of Canadian corporations based in Honduras, primarily in the mining and tourism sectors. The government of Justin Trudeau, as much as it has taken a lot of positive steps for making change in terms of social initiatives within Canada, and I think its explanation of foreign policy, I think that the importance of the investment in Honduras and the change in Canada's foreign policy to link itself very strongly with similar transnational economic activity around the world has grown to such a degree in the last 15 years that I can't see the Trudeau government taking any meaningful steps outside of possibly, you know, issuing condolences or condemnation. But in terms of changing its relationship with Honduras, criticizing the government for human rights abuses, recognizing the systematic nature of these assassinations, and over and above all of this, requiring regulation of Canadian corporations and their activity in Honduras, mm-hmm. I would be incredibly surprised if we saw any steps towards that.
Right. The Honduran authorities were warned that Berta's life was in danger, as she had received many death threats for her environmental activism. How likely is it that the authorities were connected to her death?
That's something we can't know directly at this point, and we probably won't know with any definitive certainty because it's very unlikely that a meaningful investigation will be carried out in mm-hmm. Honduras. The scenario in Honduras in terms of murder of indigenous environmental and other social movement activists is a very murky one with a lot of players involved in terms of the types of organized armed actors that utilize repression against social movements. There is the direct involvement of the Honduran military and police forces. For instance, it was the Honduran state forces that had violently evicted a group of indigenous organizers from Copin on the day that second activist was murdered shortly after Berta Cáceres. So there's the direct involvement of the military and police in general. But then there's a whole array of paramilitary organizations, vigilante groups, death squads that operate for hire, and a number of other types of armed groups that emerge out of the shadows and slip back into the shadows again, to use, to paraphrase the words of Eduardo Galeano, who looked at paramilitaries in Central America a number of years ago. It's difficult in any one case to point to who the person with a mask on a motorcycle was who killed an activist, or who it was that kicked down the door and pulled the trigger. But regardless of who pulled the trigger and killed Berta Cáceres, it's very clear that the DESA corporation that is building the mine, the dam, is either possibly ordering attacks of this sort, but definitely ignoring them and allowing for them to happen, even if they're not directly involved in it. And the same goes for the Honduran government as well. Both the company involved, even though we can't point to a company manager or a company security guard who might be carrying something like this out, both the company involved and the Honduran government actively encourage and facilitate these sorts of assassinations by ensuring that there's total impunity every time that they happen.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Berta's legacy will be as a result of the work she's done and as a result of her death?
I think her legacy is already an encouragement for Indigenous communities and other social movement organizations to continue organizing despite the violent repression that they're facing. As one of the more visible people and stronger voices of the movement, she was constantly under a threat. She had been arrested and assaulted, and there had been attempts on her life in the past, but it didn't dampen her spirit for organizing or resistance. I think it made it stronger. And with her murder, I think it sends the same message, or reinforces that same message, to the rest of the movement, to continue their organizing work. And you see that in Honduras. Nothing has sort of fallen off or become more quiet because of the threat that was represented by her assassination. To the contrary, there's been stronger organizing in the wake of it. And the other piece of the legacy, I think, is connecting a lot of, dormant potential for solidarity from outside of the region to start to wake up and make noise and demand accountability from the headquarters of the governments and corporations that support the activities that are leading to repression of this sort.
Mm-hmm. And we have reached the bottom of the hour. And you're listening to Human Rights Radio. I'm Jim Hutchings with Daylene Sliz and our special guest today, Simon Konofsky-Larson. And we're going to take our break. We've got some special music to listen to after that. And we'll continue our discussion about human rights in Honduras.
Camino y Tomás en el torrente de sus aguas, que corre el río Gualcarque, Tomás en su corriente y Paul en la alegría que nos baña.
Su esperanza sobre el mundo.
Que corre el río Gualcarque.
And I would think for Spanish speakers, those words are very clear. You know, lots of songs, you can't really get the words. We got the words very clearly there if you're a Spanish speaker. And could you tell us more about what the song is about, Simon?
Yes, it's a very beautiful song. I listened to it a few times before I came in this morning. I want to thank you for finding it. I didn't know about it. The song is called Song for Berta. It's written specifically about Berta Cáceres, who we were discussing in the first half of the program here. If you don't speak Spanish, it sounds like a very sad song. It has a sad melody to it, and that's definitely part of it. It's mourning her death, but it's also an incredibly hopeful song. And for that, I think it's a song that does an incredible job of summing up the tragedy and the hopefulness that are embodied in this current situation of Berta Cáceres' murder. The song is about the Rio Guadalcarque that the Lenca people are trying to stop a dam being built on. And it talks about the river and its spiritual importance for the people. It talks about the river as a source of their strength, but it also uses the river as a metaphor for Berta Cáceres herself. At one point, or at a couple points in the song, it asks about the river, where does it get so much strength, and where do so many Bertas come from? And the two rhyme in the song. De donde tanta fuerza, de donde tantas Bertas. And I like how Berta is pluralized there to mean that she, we might know about her as the visible face of this movement, but it's really saying, how is it possible that this group of people facing so much repression are so strong? Where are they getting such strength from, and how is it that there's so many incredible leaders within these people? And so it's mourning the passing of Berta Cáceres, but it's pointing to the strength of the Lenca people in general. I think it's a really beautiful piece of music.
Very inspirational, and I always cry during these radio programs of ours. I'm not going to today.
And I always cry in preparation for them.
it's you can difficult. Cry before, and I'll cry during.
It's difficult stuff to deal with.
It really is. It's, and a lot of people get strength from water, from rivers, from oceans. I know I do. I miss being close to the water, so thank you for the explanation of that. It's a very powerful song. It's very inspirational, the message behind it. Very lovely. Thank you, Simon. And welcome back to the show and to our listeners who are just joining us. We are pleased to welcome Simon Granofsky-Larsen to our show today. We're talking about human rights violations in Central America, and we'll continue on this half hour with Simon's discussion of his human rights work in the beautiful but very troubled country of Guatemala. Simon? Go ahead.
thank you. Sorry, I was preparing for a different question.
Oh.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Guatemala in comparison to Honduras. Guatemala is the northern bordering country of Honduras. And while there have been many more assassinations of human rights defenders in Honduras in the last few years, the two countries are experiencing the same change in their economic model that's being implemented across the region and through the same use of violence that's forcing this through. Really, in the period since the 1990s in Central America, there's been a shift away from the control by local oligarchies over primarily agricultural plantations for export, and a move towards the active presence of transnational corporations that are focusing on extractive industries, especially mining and hydroelectric dams. And this shift has been pushed through the use of violence, like we saw in Honduras, and there's a similar situation in Guatemala. And it's required new areas of land that hadn't been used for plantations in the past. Not in every case, but in a lot of situations, areas that had been seen as backwaters of the country are all of a sudden the sources of wealth for transnational corporations for extraction of minerals or damming mines. And so there's been a reconfiguration of the economic model that's been pushed through very quickly and very violently. We see the same kind of thing happening in Guatemala. The most contentious and violent of them have been a handful of mining projects that are active in the country. There's currently 5 active mines in Guatemala. The first one started around 2003 or 2004. I'm sorry, I have to correct myself there. There was one project that had been laying dormant since the 1970s, but in the period after the end of the civil war in Guatemala, which ended in 1996, the country took an active direction in policy to encourage reopening of mines and encourage Canadian investment in the mining sector in the country.
Speaking of Canadian involvement, how many of those mines involve Canadian companies?
All 5 of them involve Canadian companies in some way. They're either directly, entirely Canadian capital, joint Canadian-U.S. capital, or they were controlled by Canadian investors but have been sold because of the conflicts associated with them. So at some point in their short history, each of those 5 has been connected to Canadian investors. And the other thing that connects the 5 of them is that in each case, at least one person has been assassinated who is a community leader organizing to try and stop the mines from going forward. Recently, the Tahoe Resources San Rafael mine in the eastern part of Guatemala, it's a silver mine that has just opened recently, which has involved an enormous amount of state support in terms of militarizing the region in order to protect the mine. Communities affected by the mine who would either have their land taken by the mine or the environmental effects on their land, on their homes, on their agricultural activities, on the water nearby would be affected by the mine. These people have been organizing to try and stop the mine from going forward. And there's been a number of assassinations, 1 mass shooting of 7 people, 1 murder of a 16-year-old girl who was a community leader, and then a year later, the murder of her father, who was also a community leader. And there's no signs that that this rate will be slowing. Just like in Honduras, though, it's incredibly inspirational to see the energy that communities and indigenous people and social movements have in organizing to try and not just stop those specific mines, but to try and change Guatemalan society and the economy in general. This is a country that suffered through 36 years of civil war, ending in 1996 with 250,000 deaths, which culminated in genocide against the Mayan people. It's been recognized as genocide by a United Nations-backed Truth Commission and also recognized in one landmark court case in Guatemala that ruled that genocide had been carried out in the country. Now, of course, that ruling was overturned shortly after, but the fact that the country recognized the genocide had happened is significant. The same people who suffered the violence of the war, which was overwhelmingly conducted by the Guatemalan military and paramilitary forces, people who lived through the war and the future generations after them as well, are actively organizing in order to stop the new types of threats that they're facing, which are these mining projects, dams, etc. So just as in Honduras, it's incredibly inspirational to watch the amount of community organizing that's happening. But I think there's even more weight to it when you look at the situation of Guatemala with such a recent genocide within the lifespan of the same people who are now facing similar violent threats because of these new economic projects.
Speaking of the violence and the Canadian company involvement, Canadian companies have been nickel mining in Guatemala. women have been setting up their tents on the nickel, the mining, the grounds of the mining. Rapes by police and military and private security have been alleged, including the murder of a local man. These allegations are contained in three lawsuits back in 2010 against Toronto-based Hudbay Minerals Incorporated. Other lawsuits have been brought against Canadian companies over their conduct in Guatemala relating to mining. These cases will be tried in Canadian courts. It seems that these companies are taking advantage of impoverished people in developing countries. What does that say about Canada's involvement, and how can this behavior be eradicated?
I'm glad you brought up the court cases, because those represent a new tactic in social movement organizing to try and stop the violence against community organizers around these mines, and to really stop the mining projects themselves. Where Guatemalan authorities have shown themselves unwilling to respond to violence that's enacted against community members, or unwilling to carry out the type of free, prior, and informed consent consultation with Indigenous people that's required for these projects, where there's impunity in the country, the strategy has been for community members who are the victims of violence carried out by these mining companies to take their demands to Canadian courts instead. And it's happened over the last 10 years. There's kind of been an arc to organizing in Canada for how this has happened. The first attempt was to get legislation passed in Canada through the parliament that would require Canadian companies to be subject to Canadian regulation even when they're active outside of the country. Currently, Canada says that when our mining companies step outside of the country, then we have no jurisdiction over the actions that they do, that it's the responsibility of the local governments. But as we see in countries like Honduras and Guatemala, most of those governments are in some cases unable, in many cases unwilling, to respond to violations. And so there was an attempt to pass legislation that would place a minimum set of regulations on how Canadian companies would be responsible for their actions outside of the country. It failed ultimately, but it led to the plan to bring Canadian mining companies to court in Canada, which is the result of organizing between solidarity organizations based in Canada who worked with communities in Guatemala, Honduras, other countries. So the organizing is really happening at the level of the local communities, but they're reaching out for solidarity support from organizations in Canada who are willing to back them in these processes. There's been two instances of court cases that Canadian courts were willing to hear. There were, I think, four prior to these that Canadian courts threw out the proposal that victims of violence of Canadian mining companies should be heard in Canada. So there were some prior attempts that weren't successful, and now there's been two instances of cases brought to the court. Victims from Guatemala have come to Canada, have had their arguments heard in one case in Toronto, one case in Vancouver. Both of those have been thrown out also at advanced stages of the proceedings, so neither of them have gotten to the stage of a ruling that would be in favor or against the mining companies for their actions. But I see these as first steps, and really important steps, towards Canadian courts establishing a precedent eventually that if a Canadian company is shown beyond any doubt to have been involved in assassination or violence against communities, community leaders in the areas where they operate, that Canadian courts will be willing to hear those. The two cases that have been heard so far in Canada, the one that you mentioned, Hudbay Minerals, it's a nickel mine, and there's been a long series of violence against communities whose land was taken to be used for that mining project without their consent. The recent instances that were subject to the court case were, I think it was 9 women, either 9 or 11 women, who were gang raped by company security guards.
It was 11 women.
11.
Yeah.
And then also an attack on the community that left one community leader, who is himself a school teacher, murdered, and mm-hmm. another man paralyzed. And so the paralyzed man, the widow of the man who was murdered, and the victims of the alleged gang rape brought cases forward to the Ontario, I think the Ontario Supreme Court, mm-hmm. somewhere in the Ontario court system. The other instance was what I had mentioned earlier, the Tahoe Resources mm-hmm. silver mine in eastern Guatemala. There was a case brought against that company, which was based in Vancouver, for an attack that wounded 7 community members who were organizing against the mine. And like I mentioned, after sort of quite a few steps along the way in the hearing, the judge decided that the case shouldn't go forward.
What was his reason for that? Is it basically because we don't have the legislation in our Canadian system of laws to do that? I guess basically what I'm saying, does Parliament need to do something here?
Absolutely, Parliament needs to do something, but I think that we got as far as we can reasonably expect to get before maybe another movement builds up around this, where that bill to hold companies responsible fell apart. I can't see that happening again anytime soon because of the amount of energy and opposition to it as well. So I really think that the mm-hmm. The movement on an individual case through the Canadian courts is going to have much more than the effect on that individual case, as important as that is. That's where the legal precedent is going to be established. To allow for other cases, not just from Guatemala or Honduras, but Canadian companies are involved in other in similar violations mm-hmm. around the world. And one case that would hold a company responsible in Canada, I think, would open the door to quite a few more.
A number of us were disappointed with the Liberals when that bill failed because the government was in a minority position at the time, and had everyone been on side on the mm-hmm. opposition, that bill would have passed. And because of the failure of the Liberals to step up, it failed. And personally, I'm looking for the government to now do something that would make it possible to have these companies do the right thing in terms of human rights in the countries in which they're operating.
Well, maybe now is the time to push on this again then, because we do have a Liberal government in power that at least on the surface is making declarations very much in support of the return of Canada's role in foreign policy to a defense of human rights. I was speaking earlier about my cynicism about how their willingness to go forward on that in any sort of deeper structural way, but this could be a good moment to try and hold the Trudeau government to account for one of the primary instances of Canadian human rights violations around the world. So it's really a time where Canadians could be building on the momentum that has sort of sprung onto the international scene from the murder of Berta Cáceres, and demanding that the Canadian government not just change its ways in Honduras, but take meaningful action on regulating the activities of Canadian companies abroad. I don't think that there's any way that the Canadian government would do that of its own accord, and so that's something that really requires pressure from Canadians, from existing groups like Amnesty International that has the capacity to mobilize people, the Council of Canadians, Mining Watch Canada, organizations like this. But it's really something that Canadians need to appreciate that it's happening mm-hmm. and see the power that we have potentially as a collective to hold our government and our companies to account. Because as strong as community organizing is in Central America, I don't think that we're going to see an end to these sorts of violations if that organizing isn't backed in solidarity from the countries that are the source of a lot of the violations.
I've got an item that I printed off our Amnesty site in which Amnesty suggests some things that we can do. And one of the things we can do is share this action that we have for to find the killers of Berta Cáceres. We can send a tweet to the president of Honduras, and it gives you the information. The other thing that we can do is send a letter of concern to Canada's foreign minister, Stéphane Dion, calling on him to use Canada's relationship with Honduras to press for an impartial, exhaustive, credible investigation to find the killers of Berta Cáceres by complying with the request of her relatives and colleagues for technical assistance by a team of independent international experts appointed by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Implementation of protection measures requested by the IACHR for Berta's relatives, and guarantees that no development project advances without meaningful consultation and the free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples whose lands and rights will be affected. So we can do stuff. We just have to get out there and write and make our concern known to our elected officials, particularly Stéphane Dion, but we can send letters to Justin Trudeau and your MP, and it all counts.
It does. Every little bit helps.
Yes,
it's the only way that we're going to exact change in the world and in our own country, if we take steps to make some changes.
You know, and we've already seen that exactly the kind of actions that you're talking about have had effect in relation to Berta Cáceres. Gustavo Castro, who was the witness and also shot during the murder of Berta Cáceres, when he was held against his will as a witness, I think it's clear that the only reason he was released and allowed to go back to Mexico was because of the groundswell of letter-writing campaigns and petitions and tweets of exactly the kind that you're talking about, that the Honduran government eventually responded to in lifting the travel ban on this one person and allowing him to go back to Mexico. Now, of course, it's going to take even greater pressure to make an investigation happen into her murder, and especially one that is willing to look deeply into the role of the government and the company involved, but I don't think it's beyond the possible either. And so this is somewhere that we need to put our energies.
It's hard to be optimistic, but at the same time we have to try.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings us to the end of our hour, just about. I have a duty here to inform everyone about our Look and Listen lottery on CJTR. And that's one of the ways that we fund community radio and makes it possible to have informative programs like this on CJTR, where we discuss important issues in which we can make differences in people's lives around the world. So, let me tell you about the lottery. The grand prize this year is a choice of four locations. You can get a trip to Cleveland, Ohio, to Nashville, Tennessee, to New Orleans, Louisiana, or to Las Vegas, Nevada. Your choice. There's lots of interesting things to see and do in each one of these places, and if you win, you have to make that choice. The second prize is a $1,000 travel voucher from Carlson Wagenli Rickert Travel, and third prize is a Regina Folk Festival 2016 experience. Two weekend passes to Regina Folk Festival 2016. Tickets are only $20. You can get them here at the station. You can call us up. We can do it with a credit card over the phone. This is during regular business hours. If you know any CJTR programmers, such as myself, we can provide you with a ticket. There are only 1,500 to be sold. And the draw is going to happen, I believe, on May the 13th. Is that right, Daylene?
I think so. Yeah.
And the last tickets will be sold on the 12th. So your odds are really, really good, far better than, you know, Lotto 649.
Right.
Or,
and 13's a good number.
13 is a very good number, for sure. So with that done, and I encourage you to get your ticket today, we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."